Okay, so welcome to our new class. This class is entitled Just Do Something, almost Just Do It. It's going to be a book study on this book by Kevin DeYoung. It's a very small book. The title is Just Do Something, A Liberating Approach to Finding God's Will, or a book with a subtitle like this is obviously sanctified. How to Make a Decision Without Dreams, Visions, Fleeces, Impressions, Open Doors, Random Bible Verses, Casting Lots, Liver Shivers, Writing in the Sky, etc. Now, first off, who has read this book before? One time in the past 6 months, who has read this book one time? Who has read this book two times? Who has read this book three times, including this time? This will be the third time through for these high school girls who have now, this will be their third time studying the book, which clearly confirms it is God's will that they read and study this book.
We're trying to make the same message.
That's right. Or we're trying to make it very clear that they need to hear this. Okay? And we're not satisfied that they have. Well, I apologize to those who have been through this so many times. You'll have to sit through it one more time, but we thought it might be something that was useful to go through again, so you will be the experts ready to teach this the next time through. The book is by Kevin DeYoung, like I mentioned. He's a pastor of a PCA church in East Lansing, Michigan, where Michigan State is, University Reformed Church, and there's a little bit about that, actually, how he came to be there. But there's a foreword by Joshua Harris, by the way, who many may know as the author of I Kissed Dating Goodbye, and I forgot what the sequel was called, but Boy Meets Girl. Yeah, I think I read at least the first book in that. It was pretty helpful. So Joshua Harris is pretty popular in today's pop Christian culture. So he writes a foreword to your book. I don't know exactly what that means. We're going to go through it. I don't know how long the class is going to take. Today I wrote four, just a few headings on four chapters. I don't know if we'll really get through that. I'm just going to kind of see how it goes, and we may be in here 2 weeks, we may be in here 6 weeks, but I'm going to try not to be too repetitive, so we'll see exactly how that goes. So a few quick introductions. So the topic is finding God's will, and there are many, many books on the market, especially you go to your Christian bookstore, and especially since we're being recorded, I won't make too many comments about things like the Christian bookstore, but you'll find a number of different titles on the shelf that help you discern God's will. And this is especially true in today's generation. I don't exactly know what that means, today's generation. But I'm going to say basically, most likely anyway, 15 to 55-year-olds. but especially those in, say, late junior high, high school, college, young adults. This is an especially hot topic. But it's also true, as we'll find in some of what he says, even in some who are a little bit older, who we might think already have everything together. It's especially geared towards some of the younger crowd. I know many here are maybe fit that demographic, but hopefully it won't be completely lost on or boring for those who may have already figured all this out. The other thing I might mention is that one thing I've appreciated about our congregation here is I don't hear, at least not from the pulpit and not from the teaching chair, a lot of content that would run counter to this. I think thankfully we've done a decent job of following some of the principles that he lays out in the book. So in one sense, it's maybe not a huge challenge for us, but in another, I think it still is. We're all kind of subject to the culture that we live in. We deal with Christians from a lot of different walks of life, and there is there's a tension here in this notion of finding God's will. So we'll go ahead and go through it. If you say to yourself, well, this is obvious, then that's fine. But there might be plenty who are challenged, or all of us may have struggled a little bit with some of the kinds of things that we may take on a little bit. Now, I'm going to try not to be too controversial. If I say something that's controversial, then that means either you didn't understand me correctly and you weren't listening quite carefully enough, or it was Kevin DeYoung's fault and I'm just quoting something that he said, so you can email him. His website is revkevdeyoung.com, so it was obviously not something that I said wrong. And we'll make sure and delete it from the recording too. Hopefully I won't step on too many toes directly. Okay. So as we consider finding God's will, we know that the tendency that all of us, I think, have, we approach a decision, especially a decision that involves the rest of our lives. Where am I going to go to school? What am I going to major in? What am I going to try for my third major now that I've abandoned my first two majors? What career do I want to pursue? Where should I work? Whom should I marry? Should I get married at all? Where should I live? All these kinds of things are a very big deal. We feel like they're going to affect the rest of our lives, and sure, they will. Especially certain decisions when we have a commitment, like we do to, say, marriage. That's a decision we don't take lightly, unlike the culture where you can simply start over anytime you want. Hopefully we're all agree that marriage is a little bit stronger commitment than that. So yeah, it's a big deal. It'll affect the rest of your life. When we approach these kinds of decisions, it's very common for us to wonder, what is God's will? We want to please God. I'll get into this a little bit more in chapter, I think it's chapter 3, but we have certain motivations that cause us to want to know God's will and to follow it. We have comfort. We want to walk faithfully. So it's good that we seek to know what's God's will. But we might get off track a little bit on how we do that. So I've appreciated this book by DeYoung as a way. It indeed is a liberating approach to finding God's will, especially compared to what tends to happen out there. I've been involved in some recent decisions personally, and then also for certain nonprofit organizations that I help with, where I've been faced with this sort of thing. What does God want here? We want to make sure we're following His agenda, not asking necessarily Him to follow our agenda. How can we discern what His agenda is so we can get on board with what He's doing and follow in that sense? Okay, so it still affects us. Even if all of our theology we think is fairly well ordered and is well founded, we still struggle with some of these questions from time to time when the rubber meets the road. So we'll jump in. Chapter 1 is called The Long Road to Nowhere. The Long Road to Nowhere. It's kind of a short introductory chapter. And DeYoung makes the claim that our generation, reference what I said earlier, what exactly does our generation mean? But he's typically talking, I think, about your say, 15 to 17-year-olds up to, say, 35. I mean, just kind of that generation. That's his generation. I think he's a 30-something. Our generation is the tinker generation, according to him. The tinker generation. We tend to not be very consistent. We're not very stable. We tinker with just about everything. We don't make decisions. We don't follow through. And, by the way, I forgot to mention, this book is not very long, and it's written as a kind of a very, it's a readable style. It's not a high written style here. This is not, say, John Owen or something. So you can probably read this book way faster than we can go through the class, and you might want to do that, but I'll try to expound some. I'll just throw out some of these statements that he makes, and I won't qualify them entirely, but he goes through a number of examples of how our generation tends to tinker with things, and just we tinker with relationships, we tinker with churches, and I've seen this a lot, kind of in the pop culture, if you will, and even in the pop Christian culture, we kind of try churches, and we try relationships, and we kind of tinker and dabble with this, and young adulthood, quote unquote, keeps getting longer and longer. And so it's possible, he says, that in our unparalleled freedom to roam, it's not made us wiser, more circumspect, or more cultured or more mature. It's possible that it's not done that, but instead it's just allowed us to kind of get high-centered. He says the goal of this book isn't to help you hear God's voice in making decisions, but rather to help you hear God saying, get off the road to nowhere and make a decision. So that's his bold claim here. The hesitancy we feel in settling down and making decisions, and therefore diligently seeking the will of God, has at least two sources, according to DeYoung. So first, he says the present generations, especially when I say generations, reference all I just said about who I'm most likely talking to. They're probably not our parents, or for some of us, even our grandparents. I'm not talking about the greatest generation, maybe the World War II generation, and probably not even the baby boomers, but at least Generation X, Generation Y, or I forgot what the other latest generation is. But there's a term for it out there. First, the present generations enjoy, or at least think they enjoy, unparalleled freedom. Unparalleled freedom. So, kind of the world is our oyster, comes with wide open possibilities of kind of almost doing whatever we want. And that sounds great, but then it brings with it a bunch of anxiety and indecision. And so that's the first reason he thinks that we have trouble settling down and making decisions. And second, in our search for the will of God has become an accomplice in the postponement of growing up. Convenient out for the young. So we pass off our instability, our inconsistency, and our endless self-exploration as looking for God's will, as if not making up our minds and meandering through life were marks of spiritual sensitivity. So, as a result, we're kind of full of passivity and empty on follow-through. And so he says these are two of the reasons why they're sources of our hesitancy in settling down. So that's mostly what he tackles in the first chapter, which is a fairly short chapter. Why do we tend today to have trouble making decisions that, say, our parents or our grandparents didn't seem to have? So let's roll on into chapter 2, where he starts to talk about what we mean by the will of God. Chapter 2 is entitled... See, that was fast. Chapter 1, done. Chapter 2, and I'm not even asking for questions or comments. We'll wait till the end. The will of God in Christianese. The will of God in Christianese. So, if God... He asks a question. If God has a wonderful plan for my life, why doesn't He tell me what it is? God has a wonderful plan for my life. Why doesn't He tell me what it is? How can I discover it? I'm going to read he has a long list of questions right here at the beginning on chapter 2. What should I do this summer? What should my major be? What kind of career do I want? Do I want a career? Should I get married? Whom should I marry? Do I want kids? How many kids? Should I play sports or sing in the choir? Where should I go to college? Should I even go to college? Should I go to grad school? What job should I take? Should I stay in my current job? Should I be a missionary? Should I be a pastor? Should I volunteer here or there? Should I leave home and test the waters elsewhere? Is now the time to buy a house? Where should I spend my money? Where should I give my money? Where should I go to church? How should I serve in my church? What should I be doing with the rest of my life? And where? And with whom should I be doing it? When should I retire? What should I do in retirement? On and on and on and on. So, he says, could it be that we have difficulty discovering the will of God, His wonderful plan for our lives, because He doesn't intend us to? This will fly. I'm going to read a quote here in a little while. It kind of flies in the face of a lot of teaching that's out there, actual formal teaching that's out there. And I may name one name at least. And I hope he quotes him correctly, because I'm going to be reading a quote of a quote. But could it be that God doesn't intend for us to find His will exactly the way we are thinking of it for all those decisions? So he says, are you confused yet? The will of God is one of the most confusing terms in Christianity. We say it a lot. It's in the Bible. What the will of God. So according to DeYoung, and I think this is pretty solid. I didn't cross-reference this with some of our favorite commentators, but I think he's on pretty good track here. Of three different meanings or definitions, usages of the term the will of God. So according to DeYoung, there are three. First of all, there's God's will of decree. And I can always ask maybe the high school girls to define all of these wills that they've been through so many times now. God's will of decree. So everything that comes to pass, and we see this in the Bible, God's will, His will of decree. Everything that God that comes to pass is God's will of decree. So we can say that it was God's will of decree that Adam and Eve would sin. Yet God is not the author of sin. It was God's will of decree that September 11th would happen, and that you would be born, and that you would have these great times and you would have these bad times. Everything that comes to pass is according to God's ultimate will of decree. He is completely sovereign. So that's our first usage, our first meaning of God's will. Can't be thwarted. It's every minute detail. It was God's will of decree that you would be here today. That you would be sitting exactly where you're sitting. That you'd be wearing what you're wearing. That you'd be thinking what you're thinking right now. That you would have for breakfast what you had for breakfast. Or that you wouldn't eat breakfast. He holds every tiny element of our lives in His control. And that's a comforting thing. And I think the Bible will point that out as a comfort to us. God has every minute detail of our lives under His control. He knows how many hairs are on our heads, and that number as it changes day by day for some people. And it's getting easier and easier for God to remember that in certain cases. But let's consider, for example, Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. I'll go ahead and read that. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. So that's a good verse there to remind us of God's ultimate will of decree. The will of God, His will of decree. It's the ultimate determination of all things. And it's comforting, and it can also maybe be, I won't say intimidating, but just it's something to be fearful of in a good way as we realize that we cannot get outside of God's will of decree. He is completely, He's all-powerful. He is to be feared. Secondly, God points out the way. So the second usage of God's will, according to DeYoung, is God's will of desire. His will of desire. So this is essentially what God has commanded. What He wills of His creature, what ought to be. You shall not murder. You shall not steal. You shall not commit adultery. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Plenty of things that we find in the Bible that remind us of what God's will is. He has said what His will is, and He has commanded us. Jeremiah 25, which I'm not going to read in its entirety, shows that He sent Babylon to punish Judah. Judah had been quite unfaithful. He sent Babylon as His instrument. If I recall there, He even says, my servant Nebuchadnezzar, He sends to destroy or to take captive and to seriously harm Judah. And then later He punishes Babylon for their wickedness. So God commands both Judah how to behave. He commands all creatures to keep His will. And yet we can also see according to His will of decree, they work together. He cannot be thwarted in His will of decree. But be careful how I say this. God can be, quote unquote, thwarted in His will of desire, in as much as He says, you shall not murder, but people murder every day. And in fact, you murdered probably yesterday and maybe even already today when you hated your brother without a cause. So all of the time we do what's called sin, and we run contrary to God's will that we shall not sin. We should be holy. Okay? So we do what's pleasing in His sight, and He's revealed what's pleasing in His sight, which is obedience to His commands, and then we also disobey those things. And I'll read a verse here as well, Deuteronomy 29:29, which is a very helpful verse that might be the, as far as I can tell in the Scriptures, one of the most concise verses to bring both of these wills together. In fact, I think it's almost tweetable because it's a very short verse. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of the law, of this law. Let me read it again. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. So here we see the interaction right there, that the secret things belong to God. And there are plenty of things which are secret. I submit that those may constitute His will of decree, but His will of desire is revealed to us. It's right in the Scriptures, His will for your life, what we should do and what we should be about. So thirdly then, we have His will of decree and His will of desire, and according to DeYoung, does God have a specific plan for your life, what we might call His will of direction? Does God have a secret, detailed, specific plan, a will of direction? Well, yes. I mean, it's according to His will of decree, and He certainly knows where you will go to college, or if you will go to college, and what you will study, and so on. But the big question here, the real clincher, the linchpin, is whether or not He expects us to figure out His will of direction beforehand. According to DeYoung, no. He does not expect you to figure out His will of direction beforehand so that you may then walk according to every little piece of it and have no problems in life. God does have a specific plan for our lives, but He does not expect us to figure it out ahead of time. And he wanted to point out, he had made a statement or two, I think, in conferences he'd done or something, where he makes some fairly bold statements meant to be provocative, and he's maybe stepped on a toe or two or discouraged somebody. God does have all of these things under his control. He does care where you go to college or if you go to college. He does care about these decisions that we make. But he does not expect us to figure them out beforehand and use them as a blueprint. And there are some who will, and this is where we start to run contrary to the, I think, to the culture today, because most of the people that I've encountered, or a lot of the Christians that I've encountered, are infatuated with this will of God, this part of God's will. And that's what we're going to spend a good bit of the time in the class kind of encountering, is this notion that if we don't figure out God's will of direction beforehand, we will then be outside of God's will of direction. We will be outside of His will, and the universe will come unraveled for our lives. Our lives will blow up. And in illustration of this point, here's a fellow. I guess I'll go ahead and name names here. If you don't like this, then you can email Kevin DeYoung at... That's probably on his website. But I have not read this book, but he quotes a book called The Will of God as a Way of Life by Gerald Sitzer. And so here's a passage from that book that may, in fact, I'm going to read a little bit of a preface to it and then the quote. So DeYoung says, his book helped me crystallize my understanding of what I felt was wrong with the traditional understanding of God's will. Here's Sitzer's explanation of the usual and misguided way of looking at God's will. So here's the quote. Conventional understanding of God's will defines it as a specific pathway we should follow into the future. God knows what this pathway is, and He has laid it out for us to follow. Our responsibility is to discover this pathway, God's plan for our lives. We must discover which of the many pathways we could follow is the one we should follow, the one God has planned for us. If and when we make the right choice, we will receive His favor, fulfill our divine destiny, and succeed in life. If we choose rightly, we will experience His blessing and achieve success and happiness. If we choose wrongly, we may lose our way, miss God's will for our lives, and remain lost forever in an incomprehensible maze. I kid you not, that's what it actually says. Unless it's taken out of context and he's actually being sarcastic there. I don't think he is. That's actually written in this book that I don't know where it is on the bestseller list, but people are reading this. Yikes. Okay? That would come as a welcome, I think, as a welcome statement to many in our culture and in the Christian, in the broader Christian church, who are seeking to find God's will, and they say, "I've got to find this path. I've got to know exactly where it goes. It's a very complicated path. It might have lots of turns, and if I don't know it, my life may become unraveled. I will be outside of God's will. I have failed to seek Him. I'm not doing a good job for God, and so on. It's very intimidating." According to DeYoung, waiting for God to reveal some hidden will of direction is an invitation to disappointment and indecision. There are a number of problems with this, and he's going to get more into detail on that. Trusting God's will of decree is good. We know that everything that comes to pass is according to this will of decree. Following His will of desire is obedient. Waiting for His will of direction is a mess, and it allows Christians to feel more spiritual the less they actually do. The less they actually act, or the less decisive they are, the less they do, the more spiritual they feel like they are. It's this sort of crazy reciprocal relationship. And the less I do, the more spiritual I am, because I'm waiting to discern the will of God. See, and I don't want to be one of these non-circumspect, unprayerful people that just charge in and don't really consider what they're doing. By the way, there are pitfalls, as usual, on both sides of the road, ditches on both sides of the road here, where we might charge in and not be circumspect. We're going to get into that. So he wants to remind us that God is not a big magic eight ball. Everybody remember those eight balls? Did you ever get one that you shake it up and it's got the little pyramid inside, and you turn it over and you ask it a question and it comes up with yes, no, maybe, it's unclear, yes, you charge right in. They used to be a toy. They sold them at Spencer's. Not that I ever saw them in there, but God's not our big magic eight ball that we're going to shake up and see what answer we're going to get. We know God has a plan for our lives, but the problem is that we expect Him to tell us what it is beforehand. And the better way, he says, is the biblical way. Seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. then trust that He will take care of our needs even before we know what they are and where we're going. So you can see now how we start to diverge from the pathway that's often put forth, maybe not always as clearly in one short paragraph as Sitzer's comments here, but oftentimes in just about as many words. And the Christians that we talk to a lot are going to be struggling with this sort of thing, and we may find that we are. I even recently myself, I found a decision before several of us, and I'm trying to think, okay, what is God's will? It's a fork in the road. We could go this way, we could go that way. We want to know what God wants for our ministry. We want to know which way we should go. We don't want to be running counter to His will for the ministry. We certainly know that we're going to require His blessing every step of the way. We don't, and I don't think we were saying that we're going to offend Him and He's just going to withhold all blessing, but He might. I mean, He may or may not open doors and so on, depending on what we do here. It's still tough, even when you're thinking through these kinds of ideas and you think you've got this nailed down. It becomes tough when you're faced with these big decisions and you want to do what's right. The key, I think, is going to be being guided by wisdom, which is what we'll talk about later in the book, which is not always an easy thing either. So there are ways that we might use prayer and the Scriptures and several other means to make wiser decisions without saying, I'm going to understand God's blueprint for my life beforehand. So that's chapter 2. We're just rolling along. The will of God in Christianese. What does the will of God mean? Does it mean His will of decree, His will of desire, or His will of direction? Everybody seems to be focused on His will of direction. I'll pause there, I suppose, if I must, and ask, before we go into chapter 3, if there are any comments or questions so far. Anybody want to get a word in edgewise? Does it make sense so far? Does this kind of hit home with where we find ourselves as we try to make decisions? Okay. Forgot to mention, by the way, there are two extra copies of this book because we went through this with the CY. So I think these will be in the church library. I've been meaning to bring these in, so I assume available for checkout if you'd like to read through it. I also have the audio of this, although I don't know what the sharing rules are on that, but you can get this as an audio book, and that's pretty handy as well if you're like me and you need to be able to listen on the go. Okay, so chapter 3, which is probably as far as we'll get today, I think. Directionally challenged. Directionally challenged. So we'll talk about why so many Christians are desperate to find the will of God and why there are so many will of God books, like this one, or maybe different than this one, on the market. And if I step on your toes here, again, it must have been God's will that I do that. He's trying to tell you something. It's a sign. And try not to be too offended. Make sure that you didn't misunderstand me. Now, think about these things. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to go through the points that DeYoung makes. But if you find that I'm kind of encroaching on some struggles that you've had, let's think through these things together. Let's consider whether or not there might be a better way, which is what he'll get into later. And I don't know. Try to have an open mind. So he gives five reasons why are we so desperate to find the will of God. Potentially, or most likely meaning his will of direction, why are there so many will of God books? Reason number one, according to DeYoung, we want to please God. We want to please the King. And I hope we can all relate to that. We say to ourselves, I serve this King, this great and mighty King, I want to please Him. I want to do what He wants. So, we want to please God, we sincerely want to be in His will and doing what He wants us to do. This is a good desire. Would anyone disagree that it's a good desire to want to serve and please your King, to do His bidding? I hope not. But he also wants to point out again that it's not. This is not how God's will works when we apply it to His will of direction. Over-spiritualizing every decision we make tends to make us miserable. And our misdirected piety makes following God more mysterious than it should be. But our first reason for struggling here is a good thing. How would I say this? It's good to want to please God, and perhaps the way we're applying that is what's misguided or misdirected a little bit, and that's where we get off in the weeds a bit. So first reason is, we want to please God. The second reason he gives, that we have this multiplication of books and discussions on finding the will of God, is that some of us are timid. Some of us are very timid. And I've encountered this. I look at my own personality and the way I tend to do things, my own professional experience and just the way my life has gone. And that may differ quite a bit from other people who have different personalities and different tendencies in the way they make decisions and approach things. I've even seen among those I'm fairly close to, friends or family, that just they're just cut out of a different cloth than I am. I'm not saying which one of us is better. I'm just saying that we're cut out of a different cloth. We have different personalities, and some of us are timid. And it's hard for us to move forward. We're shy, we're timid, we're a little bit apprehensive. The entrepreneurial go-getter types, okay, they may not shy back. They may charge in and do things. They take risks. And you know, they just kind of fly by the seat of the pants. All right? Some people are not cut out for that. Some people will go crazy if they were to try to live the entrepreneurial life or charging in, and they don't know the future and they don't have all their ducks in a row and they don't have all their numbers lined up to take the risk out of decisions. And some people are just very deliberate and cautious. They want to be sure of what's coming. They don't want to take risks. They're very averse to taking risk. And so they mean well, but he asks whether they, not they might be admonished by 1 Thessalonians 5:14, which says, "Now we exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all." So perhaps one intention there is when we talk about the faint-hearted, I guess I'm essentially equating the timid with the faint-hearted. I don't mean this in a bad way. I don't think it's wrong or sinful to be timid. But perhaps we do that too much. We may get a little too timid or become faint-hearted and fail to move forward in what might appear risky, trusting God. We might hang out on the sidelines too long. On the other hand, of course, we might be too brash, too bold, and we don't even consider what God may want, and we just charge in and take foolish risks. Again, ditches on both sides. So those who are very timid may have the best of intentions, but do need our patience and help. So if you find yourself being one of these who are very timid, it might help to recognize that. You understand yourself better that way and say, I'm a person that I just struggle with taking risks. And God may use that to an advantage, especially in group discussions or group decisions. I've appreciated that, being involved in decisions where I have, you're more analytical. I'm not equating analytical with timid, but those who are more risk averse and really want to have things thought out carefully on paper, all their ducks in a row, versus those who are tend to just kind of go in guns a blazing. So I think it's a good balance that may exist in the church, but we need to recognize that. So that's number two of his. I have these numbered right. We want to please God. Some of us are timid. The third reason that this multiplication of will of God books and so on may occur is because, according to DeYoung, we want perfect fulfillment. We want perfect fulfillment. Many of us, and I think this is pretty true, many of us have it so good here that we begin to look for heaven on earth. Okay, we get the attitude, perhaps, that life is like a 5-star hotel. I stayed in a 5-star hotel once. It was fabulous. And if you ever get a chance to stay, watch Orbitz. Because if there's a quirk in their system or something, and if you play your cards right, interesting analogy to make here, you just might get a 5-star hotel for a crazy price. If you do so, I highly recommend it. Or maybe not, because you may find that you never can stay anywhere else. You've got your standards are way too high now. We get the attitude, though, that life is like a 5-star hotel, where they turn the corner of your bed down and put a rug, a little mat out by the bed, so that you don't have to step on the floor, on the carpet. And then they have the robe there, and they turn the TV on with this mute music thing, and the marble bathroom, and they call and ask if you'd like to get the weather report when your wake-up call comes in. And a little newspaper right there. When you walk in, maybe they'll give you this little cool rag in case you'd like to dab your forehead because you looked hot. This is good stuff. We get this attitude that life is like a 5-star hotel, okay? And we lose the sense that it's a pilgrimage and a struggle. Now, for some of you, some of us, I don't think struggle with this. Some of us have a hard life. We don't know what the future holds. Well, none of us know what the future holds, but some of us think we do. We don't, you know, we don't have the overt security that others may have, or we don't. We're struggling with affliction. We have sickness and disease or disability in our families. We have relationships that are broken. People haven't spoken to each other. Especially the broken relationships, I think, touches many. And so those people may not be losing the sense of life as a pilgrimage and a struggle. So when they think about people who believe that life should be a 5-star hotel, they just can't relate to that at all. We have both kinds. But we do have those who think that life is going to be like a 5-star hotel and it's going to be perfect. And we lose the sense that it's a pilgrimage and a struggle. So, we tend to forget that God has promised we would be pilgrims. And this world may feel more like a desert or even a prison for some of us than for others. If we remember that, we might find that we're happy in all things. If we remember that this life is a struggle and is a pilgrimage, we might find, I don't say that we want to lower our standards, but there's kind of this dichotomy that exists. When you think to yourself, it's merciful that God gave me breath today. I'm glad today that my house didn't burn down. I'm glad that I had a meal to eat. How about this? Read Voice of the Martyrs. We support that ministry. There's the magazine. Read that. Or read the Bible. Read Fox's Book of Martyrs. And then realize, you read any of these books or magazines, suddenly you start to realize, wow, I've got it really good. Even though I do have broken relationships, somebody could be trying to kill me today. We could be not meeting in a fairly well-lit public city building, because if they knew that we were meeting here, they would call out the SWAT team, or at least they'd have several officers here. They'd haul us off to jail. We'd have to answer for this. We don't struggle with that here. It could be a lot worse for us, but when we want perfect fulfillment, we want everything to go just perfectly, we might start to struggle with finding the will of God because we think everything's got to go just right. I don't want to have something go badly. I don't want to have a problem in my life. And so I better discern the will of God and His exact direction for me, because otherwise, especially according to the one quote that I just read, I might struggle, or I might have a problem. I don't want that. Faith in Jesus, he makes this point, faith in Jesus does not guarantee that everything will go our way. Here's something that might help us as we encounter kind of the social gospel, or this notion that if you become a Christian, you will immediately become talented and very attractive, and everything will go your way, and you know all your problems will disappear if you just trust Jesus. Like I already mentioned, there are a lot of people that trust Jesus, and they might get killed for it. So that's not what Jesus promised. For example, Abel prayed, and he died. Enoch prayed, and he didn't die. Noah prayed, and everybody else died. Okay? So this is a whole gamut here of what might happen, he says. He said some of this also might be a generational thing. When we get toward the end, we'll do a real short time on chapter, I think it's chapter 10, where he's got these two grandfathers that are still alive, Kevin DeYoung does, and he has some interesting interviews with them as we look at some of these generations that they just had different things to struggle with. And it might explain why they perhaps didn't struggle with finding the will of God the way we do. DeYoung says, my generation, I share a generation with him, so I'll say it for myself as well. My generation was the first to get A's for trying our best. You try your best, you get an A. And we get to start worshiping the self-esteem God. Okay? I had a certain Latin professor who I won't name by names, probably since we're being recorded, but I really liked, you know, we got to start worshiping in the self-esteem religion. And we try our best and we get A's because we just tried so hard, and we expect everybody to affirm us for everything, criticize us for nothing, and pay us for anything we might want to do. We get paid for that. We think we should find a job right out of college in a great location that provides the same standard of living that our parents have right now. I see my parents, they live in this, let's say our parents have done well, or they've got a nice house, they seem to be living comfortably or something, if that's in fact what they have. And we think we should have that standard of living now. I should have what my parents have. Never mind the fact that they're 20 to 40 years older than I am and have already been through a number of other things. I think I should have that standard now. We want it all, and all we need is God to show us the way. So no wonder every decision becomes so weighty when we expect such a vast and perfect fulfillment in life. Okay? We're out of whack here in what we expect from life, in our comforts and so on. So that's what he means by we want perfect fulfillment. The next one is that we have, that he goes into, is we have too many choices. We have too many choices. Okay, it's getting worse, by the way, too. All this opportunity that our technology and our culture is and the innovations of the day are yielding, just gives us choices unlike has ever been true in the history of the planet, by far. This may be one of the most crucial reasons. Previous generations didn't struggle like we do because they did not have as many choices as we have. Okay, people living on a dollar a day don't struggle with a lot of the same decisions that you might struggle with. Okay, they're interested in back then or in other places now, and maybe even for some of you here now, they're interested in trying to make sure that they can eat. They're not interested in all the 5-star hotel amenities that I talked about. They're hoping to put food on the table. And they're not burdened by lots of choices. Okay, I'm going to read an example that he gives of when he went to the grocery store. Girls, you remember this example? The grocery store. Okay. This is a book by Barry Schwartz called The Paradox of Choice. So Schwartz tells of a trip to his local, moderately sized grocery store. So maybe this wasn't Super Walmart. He found 285 varieties of cookies, 13 sports drinks, 65 box drinks, 85 kids' juices, 75 iced teas, 95 types of chips and pretzels, 15 kinds of bottled water, 80 different pain relievers, 40 options for toothpaste, 150 lipsticks, 360 types of shampoo, 90 different cold remedies, 230 soups, 75 instant gravies, 275 varieties of cereal, 64 types of barbecue sauce. Head Country is all you need there. I don't know why they even need to stock that. And 22 types of frozen waffles. 22 types of frozen waffles. So anyone who has ever shopped for groceries in North America knows that this list is only a tiny fraction of all the options found in every aisle. In a sense, we're overburdened by choice. We have so many choices. He says, you know, his wife might occasionally send him to the grocery store. She gives him a specific list. I want these things because, you know, he might just get there and spin his wheels. She said, get cereal, you know, and he's looking here, you know, there's 274 kinds. She said, get bran flakes, but there are 14 kinds of bran flakes. And, he's just kind of, he goes crazy from too many options. Of all the choices we face today, perhaps the one we least consider is, how can I serve most effectively and fruitfully in the local church? We have all these options for things we can do, and maybe oftentimes the last thing we're considering is, and I'm kind of getting, he kind of jumps ahead here of where he's going to be going somewhere else in the book, but how can I serve the local church most fruitfully? How can I love my neighbor as myself and love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength? We just have all these choices. I'm just talking about the trip to the grocery store, let alone where I could go to school. If you've done well, some of this may vary based on your personal experience. If you've done very well, let's say academically or athletically or something, you may have all kinds of options. You can go to school almost anywhere you want. Maybe your choices are more limited. Depending on what scholarships are available to you, you may find that either I haven't been able to qualify for every school, or even if I could, I couldn't possibly pay for all these different schools, so your choices are more limited. But either way, it may be that we're burdened by too many choices. And I think we'll end on, we'll get through the last one here. So those are four. And the fifth one, we're cowards. Not to be confused with we're timid, we're cowards, he says. Perhaps we're cowards. Unfortunately, it's true. Lord, tell me what to do so that nothing bad will happen to me and I won't have to face danger or an unknown. Perhaps we're cowards. Compare the world we live in now, or especially in our country and in our state, compared to, say, the New Testament church, early days, Paul doing his thing, where he's, every city he goes to, we're reading this in family worship right now, every city he goes to, same with the other apostles, the first thing they do is they go to the synagogue, the second thing they do is they get stoned. And I mean with rocks. Let me clarify that. They're beaten, they're arrested, they're at least yelled at. They go to the next city, and then those people from the first city don't just leave it there. They send an email to the next city. They come in person, and they say, these people were troublemakers in our city. They won't leave it alone. They're fought every step of the way. Okay? But today we want to have God show us His will so that nothing bad will happen, and I won't have to face that scary world and potentially have a problem or something that's uncomfortable. Well, that's not how it went down for Esther, he says. Look at how she responded to Mordecai's call to the carpet. You know, she says, he says, you've got to go to the king and stand up. here. And she says, I can't do that. I'm unsummoned. He'll kill me. You can't just go to the king without being summoned. Esther, we know the story, right? Mordecai said, well, consider whether or not God has raised you up for this very purpose. And by the way, he'll save us with somebody else. But you're going to be called to the carpet by the Lord himself for failing to do this. Then Esther told them, these messengers, to reply to Mordecai. She said, okay, go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. It's illegal. And if I perish, I perish. So, by God's good grace, she had a change of heart and decided she would go, and she might be executed for it. And we know, thankfully, we know the end now. Here's another struggle we have. We know the end of the story, right? We think, well, yeah, that was scary, but we know it turns out okay. Well, remember, she didn't know that it would turn out okay. She didn't have the book of Esther to read. Okay? She went, and it very well could have turned out, like we know in Fox's Book of Martyrs, in the Old Testament and New Testaments, and many other situations. They might be burned alive at the stake till they're dead. They suffer and are tortured. They might be crucified, like Christ and like Peter. And they may not turn out okay. So we get pretty intimidated by that, and we might either pray that everything would be fine, or we ask to know that everything will be fine. God, make sure that nothing bad happens. Make sure that I don't have to struggle. Make sure that I don't experience pain. And I'm like everybody else. I don't want pain. I would rather not have pain. I like to avoid pain if I can. But remember that sometimes pain is what God uses to sanctify us. And trial is what He uses to build us as Christians. And that's how we're refined. The refiner's fire. So obsessing over the future is not how God wants us to live, because showing the future is not God's way. His way is not a crystal ball. According to DeYoung, His way instead is wisdom. So stop looking, he says point blank, stop looking to God to remove all the risk in your life. God, take away all the risk. Many Christians struggle with this. Instead, ask Him to show you the way of wisdom. Because we have confidence in God's will of decree, all things that come to pass are according to His will, we can radically commit ourselves to His will of desire. Remember, His will of desire is what He's revealed to you to do. It's written all through the Scriptures. We have confidence in His will of decree. We can therefore radically commit ourselves to His will of desire without fretting over His hidden will of direction. In other words, God doesn't take risks. So we can. We can take risks because God doesn't take risks. We follow Him. So that's where he's trying to lead us here. And that's the end of chapter 3. Probably a good time to end here on our time. But I hope it's helpful. I mean, you can see that this matters. This very much affects how we approach all kinds of decisions. And there are many who are mired down in even the smallest decisions. I'll read a quote later from a book that's very interesting in just the minute detail to which some might think we should be discerning God's will of direction. Remember, all through the book, when I say God's will, that's one word, W-I-L-L, will. What I'm generally talking about in most cases is His will of direction that people are very hung up on. So, comments or questions so far? Any? All right, well, let's close in prayer. Oh, question?
I think my favorite searching for God's will story is a person who does the random Bible verse thing. And the first passage he turns to is like, and then Judas went and hung himself.
Right.
Oh, that's terrible. Let's try this again. And he goes, and Jesus said, go and do likewise.
Go and do thou likewise.
And he's like, no.
Three out of four.
What you do quickly. You know?
What you do quickly. That's right. Exactly. So, the random Bible verse thing could go poorly. I mean, those verses are in there, so, that's good. Any others? Let's close in prayer then.